The cedar is Lebanon's national symbol. It's on its flag, its banknotes, a source of identity and pride. But Lebanon's renowned cedar forests are not what they used to be, once a continuous carpet running up and down Lebanon's mountainous spine. These splendid forests of cedar, pine, and spruce have been exploited since the days of the ancient Phoenicians, who built ships out of them. The Egyptians used cedar in their mummies. The Ottomans, British, and French took their turn, exploiting Lebanon's forest wealth. Today, all that remains of Lebanon's vast cedar forests are a dozen fragmented islands threatened by livestock grazing and climate change. The key to restoring them is their genetic diversity. That's precisely what a Lebanese NGO called Juzur Lubnan, Lebanon Roots, has in mind. Here's a story about that. I'm in a taxi heading into the hills above Beirut. I'm going to the genetics lab and seed bank where Lebanon's famous cedars are being studied and restored.
About cedars, what's happening?
Dr. Magna Daguerre-Karat is a plant geneticist here at St. Joseph University on a pine-covered campus gazing down on coastal urban sprawl. She's also the co-founder of a Lebanese NGO called Juzur Lubnan, Lebanon Roots. Tell me about what you're doing here. You're studying the genetics of cedars.
Yes, cedars and also juniper.
Cedrus Lebani is their logo, but restoration of forest ecosystems is what Juzur Lubnan's project is all about. High and low elevation stands of pine, spruce, juniper, apple, pear, and almond, and the animals that spread their seeds, are what Dr. Karat and her colleagues aim to recreate.
Deforestation is not just about planting cedars or one kind of tree. We would like to have a forest, and forest is not composed of one single species. So we are trying to recreate the community that was living in these mountains.
Once a continuous carpet up and down its mountainous spine, Lebanon's forests have been since the days of the Phoenicians. Today, all that remains are a dozen fragmented islands, threatened by livestock grazing and climate change. The key to restoring them is their genetic diversity.
We believe that a population of trees that had a high genetic diversity, that means that it has also a high potential to adapt to whatever change will occur in the environment. We can use the most powerful genotypes that are prone to be more resistant to climate change in the field, in our reforestation campaign.
Dr. Karat takes me to her lab, where she and her students are pinpointing the DNA sequences that make native Cedrus Lebani so different from its Cypriot, Italian, North African, and Himalayan cousins, and so adapted to Lebanon's climate.
So we bring the leaves, and we just green them here with the liquid nitrogen. We extract DNA, and then we amplify this DNA. We are targeting this sequence.
Dr. Karat's lab is also identifying mammals like red fox, gray wolf, and golden jackal that spread seeds and that will have to be reintroduced if restored ecosystems are to function. So will microbe-rich soils Dr. Karat and her students are digging up in biodiverse islands up and down the country. Genetics work complete, they'll set out to rebuild forest ecosystems from the ground up, reconnecting them so genes can flow, helping trees migrate to higher, cooler elevations where their cones are adapted to release seeds.
Cedars are trying to cope by living at higher altitude, by migrating, but we have what we call the migration lag, because the trees cannot move very fast like animals do. So that's why we are doing the assisted migration. We are helping cedars to grow higher in altitude. So this is our seed bank.
And it's kind of a little chilly in here.
Hello.
Dr. Karat takes me to a seed bank run by her students in partnership with the NGO Juzur Lubnan. Anthony is one of them.
We do a process called ex situ conservation. ex situ. We take samples, seeds or plant parts, and we conserve them outside of their natural habitat, meaning in seed banks or in labs such as this one.
The first step is cleaning the seeds. Dozens are either stored or germinated to learn how they sprout best.
This is a Cedrus seedling, Cedrus libani. We find it in most forests in Lebanon, but we use it mainly for reforestation. Exactly. This is from a seed we have germinated here inside the lab. Now this seedling is ready to be put back in its natural habitat.
Optimal germination protocols in hand, Juzur Lubnan is recruiting commercial nurseries to grow seedlings in the thousands. Juzur Lubnan buys them and plants them up in the mountains. Green thumbs around the world are being invited to adopt a cedar online. 40,000 have been planted over the past 4 years with support from the European Union. Where are we going?
To the top of the mountains in Ain Majdalain.
Tony Shaheen manages Juzur Lubnan's forest restoration project. Above the town of Jizin, Tony tends a hillside of cedar and pine seedlings. A guard post sits on this windy ridge. We're in South Lebanon, Hezbollah country. Today, their post is deserted. So and is this guard post up here, this is the Hezbollah thing?
It's like a station, a check. And actually, we are friends because they help us in this project.
Tony and the guys from Hezbollah get along. Tense questions out of the way, Hezbollah forces watch over seedlings now and plant some themselves.
Here we are in the plantation site, in the second part. So here you can see the planted seedlings protected with individual fence.
Before seedlings could be planted, the Lebanese army had to be called in to remove landmines from Lebanon's 15-year civil war and Israel's 2006 invasion of South Lebanon. Doing so involved removing a meter of topsoil. Now, this terrain has been cleared of mines. I'm presuming that we can walk freely down here.
Yes, here you can walk. Here it's safe. You can walk.
Seedlings on demined land had a tough time, continually buried by rubble from mine-cleared topsoil. But most are doing well. How are seedlings doing? This looks like it's prospering.
We are happy that the cedar seedlings are growing here. So here are growing because we are irrigating them. We have almost 90% of survival rate of all species.
Not surprisingly, the seedlings that do best have the best genetics.
You can find seedlings starting 1,200 meters till 2,000 meters. Here we are at around 1,500 meters. So the seed source are from the same altitude. So they can grow, they can adapt fast and in a healthy way.
Lebanon's cedars are a source of pride for Tony Shaheen. The cedar is the national symbol of Lebanon.
Yes, but because you can find it on the flag, on the money notes, on the passport, you can find it anywhere.
So this is a selling point when you talk to local villagers and municipal leaders and the members of Hezbollah who are patrolling this area, and you tell them you're trying to reforest the area with cedars, suddenly it's something that touches their heart,
yes,
I would
yes.
think. What kind of reaction do you get?
Wow, we need to help. Can you give me some trees to plant them around my house, around my station, around my my anything? So they want to help.
The Lebanese people are proud of their famous cedars. They're also famously fractious. Driving back to Beirut, Tony describes the challenge of securing buy-in for his forest work among key stakeholders in Shia, Sunni, Druze, and Christian communities.
In my work, I had to visit all the villages in Lebanon, in south, north, Mecca, and Beirut, and everywhere.
So you're talking to Shia, you're talking to Sunnis?
To Shia, to Sunna, to Durzi, to to Christian
Hezbollah.
It's different when I talk with Jazim Meir, because he's of Tehran, he's Shiite, he has his own accent, and he talked about religion, about God, about Quran. You have to respect, you have to say, yes, you are right.
In the course of your conversation, yes, you spoke about all these things.
Yes, yes. Also like that, he talked about political situation in Lebanon. But my aim was to talk about a new project.
About reforestation. For Tony Shaheen, the diversity of the Lebanese people and the genetic diversity of their forests go hand in hand. Both are a source of strength.
All people are living in this ecosystem, and if the ecosystem is damaged, all will be affected by this damage. So we cannot take part, or we cannot be against or with. We have all be with ecosystem and helping the ecosystem.
For more information about Lebanon's endangered cedars and the work of Juzur Lubnan, Lebanon Roots, go to greenplanetmonitor.net. While you're there, subscribe. For $5 or more, you'll be helping to make this news package happen. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg. Back in 2017, astronomers feasted their eyes and focused their instruments on something Albert Einstein predicted, but no one had ever actually observed. 130 million light years away, a pair of super-dense neutron stars had collided with each other, back when dinosaurs were roaming the Earth, sending out pulses of electromagnetic signals and gravitational waves, rippling the fabric of space-time. I spoke with Samar Safi Harb about the event, named after the date it was observed, GW170817. Safi Harb is a professor of physics and astronomy and a Canada research chair on extreme astrophysics at the University of Manitoba. Can you tell me what was this collision all about that everybody was talking about and astonished the astrophysics world? Like, what actually happened?
Right, so it was an amazing event in the history of astrophysics, I would say. So the event was referred to as GW170817, because that's the date. It was an event that was detected first by LIGO, which is a gravitational waves detector. And I'm sure you've heard of LIGO big time in the news. Recently, they won the Nobel Prize prior to that event, in fact, for their discovery of the very first discovery of gravitational waves from merging black holes. So when two black holes merge, then you expect to see these gravitational waves, which result from the distortion of or ripples in space-time that have been predicted by Einstein more than a century ago now. So that was the very first direct detection of gravitational waves from merging black holes that was predicted by Einstein 100 years ago. Now, what happened in August was the very first detection of gravitational waves from merging neutron stars instead of black holes. And that was so exciting for the community because it was followed up by some 70 telescopes across the world that detected also light, not just gravitational waves from that event. So it was a new era in astrophysics where you're combining gravitational waves physics with electromagnetic radiation across the electromagnetic spectrum, from radio all the way to high energies.
So if one had been standing at a comfortable distance away from these two neutron stars, and were to actually have been able to see them, what would they have been doing before they collided with each other?
Right. So this is precisely what LIGO detected, is they would be spiraling in. There will be gravitational waves basically detected because of the ripples in space-time, because these are very strong gravity objects. A neutron star is the result of the collapse of a massive star. So stars about 10 times the mass of the sun or heavier than that will eventually die in explosions, and they make objects that we call neutron stars. These are primarily made of neutrons under extreme densities, and they have the size of a city like Winnipeg, but they are a bit more massive than the sun, so they are extremely dense objects. So when you get two of these actually spiraling in together, there's extreme gravities, extreme temperatures, extreme magnetic fields being bumped into each other, it's going to be a catastrophic event. But also in the process, because of the ripples in space-time, they emit the gravitational waves. And that's what was first detected by LIGO. So LIGO told us there is something happening out there. It was actually 130 million light years away. So we're looking at what happened 130 million years ago of these two neutron stars, very dense objects, merging together and telling us that this is happening. And following that, all the telescope pointed at that event and detected it in light, which is the more typical way of studying astronomical events. But this time, this is the first time where we see both the gravitational waves, which tell us that the event is occurring indeed, not just like we think it's happening, it's for sure happening. And then we're seeing what happens after such two neutron stars are basically merging. For the first time, we are seeing what people have been predicting for decades.
Now, what I found intriguing, amongst other things, was that neutron stars are the hardest objects in the universe.
Mm-hmm. They are extremely dense objects. So, like I said, they're more massive than the sun. Their mass can range from one sun to a couple of suns. They're a bit more massive than the sun. But the size is about the size of a city, about, you know, 10 to 15 kilometers radius. And so just imagine squeezing the sun into the size of a city. You get an extremely dense matter. And in fact, the densities are above nuclear densities. They even exceed the density of an atomic nucleus. And these are basically made of a sea of neutrons, which are some of the elementary particles. And these neutrons are under extreme pressures because of the extreme densities.
So now, what would have happened when they collided with each other, black hole?
Well, that's a very good and important and extremely puzzling question at the moment. Actually, that's what people are after, understanding what happened to this merging event. So we know it happened. We know it emitted light across the electromagnetic spectrum from radio to high energy radiation. But we still do not know if the merged event led to a neutron star, a heavy neutron star, or a light black hole.
A light black hole.
Right. So the two neutron stars' masses, when you combine them, obviously, so when you have two neutron stars merging, you expect to have an object about the size of the sum of the masses, right? So the first one had a mass between 1.2 to 1.4 solar masses, and the other one is somewhere between 1.4 and 1.6 solar masses. So they're both just above the mass of the sun. If you add them together, you get a total mass of 2.74 solar masses. That total mass could be the heaviest neutron star we know or the lightest black hole we know. And it's a very important question and a puzzle to solve in the years to come. Now, people tend to think at the moment that it's most likely to be a light black hole as opposed to two neutron stars. And the reason for that is because of the light we see. So I told you that this has been observed across the electromagnetic spectrum. In the infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum, we are looking at the freshly synthesized heavy nuclei from this process, which made all these heavy elements like gold and platinum. And at the same time, in X-rays and in radio light, so in the opposite ends of the electromagnetic spectrum, we're seeing the result of the shock from the ejecta into the surrounding. And by just observing the behavior of the light in these wavelengths, people tend to believe that it's more likely to be a black hole rather than a neutron star. But this is something to be tested, I'm sure, in the many years to come.
And you mentioned that amongst the ejecta were these heavy nuclei like gold and titanium, and it had never been observed. You know, Burbage's theory about the triple alpha process and how is exploding stars just produced elements up to iron, and where do the heavier ones come from?
Exactly. Yeah.
Did people actually, astrophysicists actually observe the presence of gold and titanium and other heavy elements bursting out of?
Right. So we do have various lines of evidence to say that these heavy elements are formed in supernovae, in fact. Supernovae, like I mentioned, if you have a massive star, as it goes through its life, it's going to die, and this death makes an explosion. So as the star is evolving, it makes elements heavier and heavier than hydrogen, partly with this triple alpha process, but it goes beyond that up to the point where iron is formed. So we know that massive stars can form elements up to iron. So the question is, what happens beyond iron, right? What makes the elements heavier than iron? So supernovae are really prime candidates or suspects for this, because during the explosion itself, the conditions are such that you have neutron-rich material that's going, and there, it's extremely hot energetic environment where you can have this so-called R process, which is rapid neutron capture, which makes these really heavy elements. So that's one kind of suspect for making elements beyond heavier than iron. And that's what I keep telling my students. I personally am interested in supernovae and the remnants of these explosions. And we believe that they make some of these heavy elements. But another process that theorists have predicted make also the heavy elements is the neutron star mergers. So simulations show that if you merge two neutron stars, again, these are neutron-rich material, so obviously you have a lot of neutrons there, and so that collision is, again, extremely violent. It's going to help synthesize or form these very heavy neutron-rich materials, such as gold and platinum and the heavier elements. So, but this is the very first direct proof that these elements, in fact, were made in neutron star mergers. So, and in fact, the amount of elements made in that particular event has been measured precisely to be something like 6% the mass of the sun, which is enough to explain the heavy elements in the universe, according to the calculations by this recent discovery. In principle, we can make them with supernovae and with neutron star mergers, but what we have now from this amazing event is the direct evidence that they are indeed formed, and in amounts that could explain the heavy elements that we have, at least in our galaxy, for example.
Now, a question that's intrigued me is, what is a black hole, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, these things collided and may well have formed a black hole that they sank into.
Right.
If one were to go into a black hole, where would one end up?
So it depends.
I mean, if you were, you know, had the correct equipment and suit, you can imagine such a thing to protect yourself, and you went into a black hole, where would you end up?
Right. You don't want to do that, first of all, I would say. But it depends, you know, how far you are from the black hole. So we define black hole by what's called the event horizon. The event horizon is the distance from the black hole that tells you things will escape from there at a speed equal to the speed of light. So if you're within that radius, then nothing can escape, not even light. Nothing. absolutely nothing can escape from within that event horizon. If you're beyond that, then, you know, things will spiral around a black hole, and we believe they also make what's called an accretion disk, which is a very hot disk-like structure surrounding the black hole, and this thing shines in X-rays. And that's how we discovered black holes to start with back in the late 60s. Black holes were discovered because they shine in X-rays because of this disk form spiraling around black holes. So I guess the answer to your question is, you cannot get too close to the black hole or to within the event horizon because nothing will escape it. But beyond that, this is where the light is detected.
But so it is matter. A black hole is formed by matter. It has huge mass.
Right.
But if you were to go into it, you wouldn't come out on some other side in an alternative universe.
Right. Right. And what we have here is an example of how a black hole is formed. You could form it by colliding two neutron stars, right? This is what we just discovered with gravitational waves LIGO event, is that we have one process that makes black holes. In this case, it's a very light black hole. But there are, the black hole masses ranges from, you know, very light few solar masses all to millions and billions of solar masses. So we have supermassive black holes, which are at the center of some active galaxies. And here we have some, you know, very light black holes that result from the merging of neutron stars, for example.
Last question. Yeah. If this were to have happened closer to our solar system than 130 million light years away, if it had happened,
right.
If it were to happen, I don't know, closer, and Earth were to be bathed in this electromagnetic radiation and
exactly.
This pulse of, you know, ruffling of space-time, what effect would it have on life on Earth?
Well, I mean, first of all, if it were so close, then just the radiation that comes out of it, like this one was detected as a gamma ray burst, so there is a burst of gamma rays. The fact that it was 130 million light years away made the light diluted in the sense that it's not harmful to us, right? But you know that, and also it emitted X-rays. But we know that X-rays and gamma rays are very harmful to humanity, right? And so if this happens in our backyard, then definitely, just if you think of the heat and the X-ray radiation that's emitted, this is gonna really be very harmful for us.
Samwar Safi Harb is a professor of physics and astronomy and a Canada research chair on extreme astrophysics at the University of Manitoba. Read more about Safi Harb's research interests and GW170817 at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and YouTube, and our own home base, Blueberry. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. Shout out to CFMU listeners in Hamilton, Ontario, and CKUW fans in Winnipeg. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out for now.
Hey there, loyal listener. I'm Joaquin Shachlach, host of Free Voices on Thursday, 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock. And I'm so glad to have you around, just like CJSF. You have expansive and diverse tastes. You don't shy away from being challenged by new sounds, and you're always listening for something new. Thank you so much for hanging out with us and making us as much a part of your day as you are a part of ours. You complete us.